morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today two groups of high school students. One, Whitefish Bay High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Runnerveld High School. Would those students please stand? Delighted you joined us, and thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite high school students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the high school accepts the invitation, these students are sent materials about the case that they are going to hear with us and invited to stay after this case to discuss the case with a justice who's been assigned for the day. This is a national award-winning program, and the discussion is about the case, but about the procedures of the court in taking the case and deciding the case, not the substantive issues that are involved in the case. Now, we have a summary of the case, which I think the students have. But if anyone else in the courtroom would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you one. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Grogensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman, and you will be meeting with Justice Gableman after this case is completed. With those introductory remarks made, we'll call our second case, 09AP1351CR, State versus Greg B. Kanduch. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Kanduch is Assistant Public Defender Eileen Hirsch. Ms. Hirsch?
Thank you. As the Chief Justice said, I am Eileen Hirsch, and I represent Greg Kanduch, who was convicted in this case of a felony operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of an intoxicant. It is an unusual case in that nobody actually saw Mr. Kanduch driving or even in the car on the night in question. But the parties did agree that Mr. Kanduch had driven from his mother's home to his wife's home, a distance of about a 15-minute drive, sometime between 9 and 10:20 p.m. that evening. The parties also agreed that Mr. Kanduch was under the influence of an intoxicant at about 10:30 that evening. The question at trial was whether he drank first at his mother's home, then drove, presumably under the influence, or whether he drove first to his wife's home, parked the car, walked to a nearby bar, and then drank, which was the defense theory of the case. The evidence in support of the defense theory was Mr. Kanduch's own testimony. The evidence in support of the prosecution's theory was this piece of paper, marked Exhibit 2 and a slightly more full version marked Exhibit 13, both the same, just one is redacted, entitled BI Incorporated Daily Summary. This piece of paper includes a notation that says transmitter out of range at 2203. So if this piece of paper is admitted as substantive evidence of proof, it proved that Mr. Kanduch left his mother's home at 10:03 p.m., which of course would support the state's theory of the case. The question in the case is the admissibility of that exhibit. And as we've argued this case, there have been three lines of analysis, of possible analysis, which consider this question. Mr. Kanduch's position is that the best and most applicable line of analysis is that set forth in State versus Hansen and State versus Doar. And that is that if this is a scientific or high-tech device, that it then requires expert testimony to come in and explain to the jury how this device works and why it is designed in accordance with acceptable scientific principles. That's a necessary foundation if you have a high-tech or scientific device. That testimony was entirely lacking in this case. Now, the Court of Appeals held that it was not a scientific device because, as the probation agent testified, she was not an expert, but she testified that the device works with a radio frequency unit attached to Mr. Kanduch's ankle. It's called an electronic monitoring bracelet, usually. It sends radio signals to a telephone, which then dials a computer center in Madison, also run by the Department of Corrections. And it is true that we all use radios and we all use telephones and we all probably have computers by now. Mr. Kanduch's point, though, is that none of us really use our radios to dial telephones, not that I'm aware of, and that we don't have telephones signaling electronic monitoring centers, and then these monitoring centers coming out with a document, that we are not familiar in our daily life with that use of those technologies and the interconnection of those technologies in a way that makes this evidence understandable to the jury.
When I read this, it occurred to me we have intoxicators. Toxilizers,
yes.
We have DNA evidence. We have blood tests for paternity, pre-DNA. We've just got a lot of stuff that's admitted. Radar. And it seems as if, and maybe this is too simplistic, that we go through stages. You know, first it's challenged as a accuracy, reliability, or even does it do what it's supposed to do. You can even go back to polygraphs on that. But then it reaches a stage where it's accepted, and then you just have to show this particular machine is operating okay, as I understand it. Now, that may be an incorrect assumption about how this is handled evidentiary. So is it your position that this is still early in the stage in the courts? I mean, it may be a long term out of the courts. And as I understand it, these electronic bracelets have developed over time and have become more and more sophisticated.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the agents said that they started using an electronic monitoring system in 1987. But I believe those bracelets were different than the ones they're using now. My own experience with those was that was something where you could send out a signal and check where somebody was on some sort of a basis. That this is constantly evolving, but it is new technology. Now, parts of it have been around for a while, but this interconnection is new technology in the sense that how long we've had radar or breathalyzer machines. But the principle is the same because, Doar is an example, or Hansen, both are examples of that. One's a PBT and one's speed radar, the moving radar. And in both of those cases, they said, to determine this first thing, is this consistent with underlying scientific principles? We look to other state courts. We look to legal treatises and literature. And in Hansen, I believe it is, they say, we've looked at other state courts, and there's quite a few other state high courts that have looked at this, have gotten evidence on moving radar, and have now accepted that principle. And so by going to other state decisions in other state high courts, we're going to accept that based on those. In electronic monitoring, as the Attorney General said in the briefing, there's very few cases. We could find very few. We have three intermediate appellate courts. Let me make sure that's right. Three cases, I guess, altogether. One was a high court. But two of them involved probation revocation hearings, where they found that it was acceptable evidence in a revocation hearing. That's a different standard of evidence than it is in a criminal proceeding. And in both of those cases, there was also, it corroborated other evidence. For example, in this one from Massachusetts, the Thistle case, that was actually a GPS monitoring system.
Even more, it was one that did
the GPS thing. But they said, look, we have his confession. We have the evidence of the probation agents who were actually on the phone with him, talking to him as he was on the beach saying he was about to go in the water, which was the violation, with his bracelet on his ankle. And he admitted that he had done that. And so they found that these records could be admitted, but they were really in support of some other information that was also brought in, and it was used for revocation. It was also used for revocation by a bail monitoring hearing in Rivers, the Texas case, by an intermediate appellate court. And they said, we'll accept that as evidence that he violated a condition of his bail. And so the only other court that we could find is an intermediate court of appeals in Arizona that said, we're accepting the electronic monitoring report as substantive evidence in a criminal proceeding. So we are
without expert testimony explaining the scientific basis. That's your point?
It's a pretty short and a non-detailed opinion, but yes, I think that's the one case where they have accepted it without expert testimony. And our point about that is that's nothing close to being accepted through courts, high courts around the country, that we are still in the early stages.
Is there any reference to this electronic monitoring in the statutes?
There is certainly in the sentencing statutes that I think there's a reference that it can be used, but I actually don't know the answer to that question, and I'm sure it's not in the evidentiary statutes anywhere.
I mean, if we were to cull the statutes of all of the states and the federal government and found some statutory references, would that in effect serve the same purpose as appellate decisions?
If you were to cull statutes that said that it is reliable and accurate as a scientific evidence in court?
Authorize the use of them.
No, I think we authorize the use of them in Wisconsin. I think that's a different question than whether their reports can be admitted as substantive evidence in a criminal trial. I mean, usually the use of them is that they alert a probation agent to investigate a possible violation. And so I think that's a completely different question. It's a completely different level of proof than using it as substantive evidence at a trial, at a criminal trial.
And Ms. Hirsch, yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
One of the proceedings that comes to mind when I read this case is the use of intoximeters in OWI cases. And typically, as a former trial court judge, what I would see is a jail employee come and testify that, yes, the machine was in good working order on the day and time that this test was taken. And then further inquiry into the scientific underpinnings generally doesn't come in. Mm-hmm. What is the rule that you would have us adopt when it comes to these, and why?
Well, first, let me just say that if you had been a trial judge 50 years ago, you would have had to have experts come in and testify about the scientific foundation.
Of the balloon.
of that intoxilizer test. And only because over the years, two things have happened in Wisconsin. One is that we've actually set up a statute that has DOT set up standards and certify certain kinds of intoxilator machines.
Certainly.
And then secondly, there can be court testimony. There can be court recognition. So that's why you had that. And then what you had was the second step, which I outline in my brief, in Hansen, which is verifiable objective proof that it was working the way it was supposed to work. And I imagine when people came in and testified in your court, they said, you know, we run a control test every day or whatever they do, and it shows that it was working, right? So I tried to come up with a simple standard because, as I say, there's the Dorr versus Hansen, we've talked about hearsay in these briefs, we talked about authentication. And the one I put in my reply brief, and I will give you again today, is I think that a computer-generated document is admissible if the proponent of the evidence describes the process used and proves by objective, verifiable testing that the computer process produced an accurate result.
Give that last part again. Proves by identifiable.
Objective, verifiable testing. And I can tell you it is in my reply brief, too. Yeah. That the computer process produced an accurate result. I think that test, it's a simple test, but what it does...
How would you envision the second part of it being proven? The first part I understand, but the second part, how would you envision that would play out?
That it produces an accurate, verifiable... I think just like with the intoxilizer test. You know, one of the interesting things in this case to me is... You know, if you look at what the crime lab analyst talked about, he said, you know, I come in the morning, I'm going to run blood alcohol tests, and so I run through a controlled substance, a controlled test, and then every sixth one is a controlled sample, and then every tenth one I do a duplicate. And it's possible that this actually exists in Wisconsin, that if you talk to the director of the computer center for the Department of Corrections, the Electronic Monitoring Center, that they actually do check, that I would guess that they check their computers, that they verify them against clocks and other things, that they check their software, they check for glitches, that there's a way of verifying that they're accurate using their computer system.
Right. So it would be almost directly analogous in that you're looking for a way to verify that the device was operating as it was intended to, as opposed to putting the state to the burden of demonstrating the technological or scientific... I agree with you in regard to the radio use of the telephone. That would be somewhat cumbersome.
Right. Well, I have to say that I think this test encompasses both parts, both the scientific basis and the verifiable testing, the kind of ongoing testing for accuracy, because it says that the computer process produced an accurate result. And I'm not a computer person, but my guess is that... You would prove that by having somebody come in and explain how the software was designed and how they check the software. I mean, I think that that's it. I think that there's probably, again, my guess is, again, that it's somebody in Department of Corrections could come in and explain. And I think the agent did a decent job of explaining how the radio frequency sends something into the telephone, which calls the computer center. There's this black hole when you get to the computer center in this case. And maybe it's because it's in Madison. I'm not sure. But I think somebody can come in and explain that and then explain their software, how the software was designed, how it was tested, why they decided to buy it, how they check it to make sure that it's working. I think that's the first step, too. That's that scientific principle. And I think it's incorporated in my little test that I put together.
Ms. Hirsch, let me, if I might, ask you this. The legislature recently, in its wisdom, has attempted to make Wisconsin a Daubert state. Given the fact that we're, at least at this point, going to be a Daubert state, what kind of expertise is going to be required? Is there one person in the computer center in Madison and only one who would be able to qualify as a expert under Daubert?
I pulled up Daubert because I do think it's applicable. And I think there's actually an interesting question for this court. If you decide this case not taking into account Daubert, although Daubert doesn't actually apply.
Right, but it will in the future.
It would not be very forward-looking to apply this case not in considering Daubert. I think it has to be part of the consideration. It says the Daubert standard is that the expert's testimony, it can be an expert by experience or training, as well as by knowledge. So I don't think, we have to have a PhD scientist. If it's based upon sufficient facts or data, the testimony is the product of reliable principles and methods, and the witness has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case. That's what the new legislation has in Section 90702. I think that's what we're saying in this case, is that this expert by experience or training has to come in with sufficient facts or data to explain how this works, what the principles are, It has, and that's the reliable principles and methods, and they have to show how they were applied reliably to this case.
Do you think then, if you go through that extra step, then the jury should receive an instruction on presumption?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just a matter of making the evidence admissible. I think it's very persuasive evidence, by the way, if it's done correctly. I mean, if you think about your crime lab people coming in and explaining it. But I wouldn't say that there's a presumption at that point. I think it makes it admissible evidence.
Let me ask you this. Do you know the answer to the question of what they would have to show? I mean, maybe the whole system just shuts down if there's a glitch. I don't know the answer to that. But if it were something that simple where it, like an intoxilizer, it won't print the results if the samples aren't within a range, or if you don't have the zeros in between, or, you know, if there's a glitch, you don't get the result. Do you know if it's something that simple? Do we know the answer as to what would be required by the state?
No, I only know. I didn't do research outside the record in this case in terms of the facts. And the probation officer did say that if there was a connection broken, that it actually would continue to work, that it'd be battery operated if the electricity went off. She did say that if a bracelet is broken, that there's an alert that goes out. But I don't. There was no indication anywhere in the testimony of what that error message. You know, what kind of error message they get if it probably doesn't shut down. But I don't know if there's something built into the system to say, whoa, there's a problem in the computer.
Does it mean line tied up on first attempt?
Right.
Or line tied up on second attempt? Does that mean they can't get through at that time?
Yeah. I think she explained it at the trial that the phone was busy. That's what that means, that when they
– So they don't know whether he's in or out of range at
right.
that time.
Right.
So I understand your first step is you think, at least at this stage, you needed an expert to testify how the electronic monitoring system works and what its scientific principles are and why scientifically it's reliable.
Correct.
And then assuming that the judge then says, okay, this is all right. This is sufficiently scientifically based and reliable that we're going to let it in. Then you need someone to say that this electronic bracelet with this method of messaging to the Madison computer was working that day.
Right.
All right. So, which didn't happen in this case. Is that right?
Well, it's my theory that it didn't happen.
Okay.
I mean, I think the state's going to argue that the probation agent's general experience that she'd never seen an error is okay. the evidence that it didn't happen.
All right.
But
so if, assuming that we pass these two tests of yours, assuming that.
Right.
Is everything hunky-dory in this case?
I think you're asking me a question that I wondered about was I prepared for this argument and didn't put in my briefs. Confrontation's a question.
Yeah, I pulled those cases.
And I have to say the
pulled the Massachusetts case of 2009, and there's now pending a case. Let's see if I can find that. I think it's Donald Bullcoming versus New Mexico. Is that right?
Yes, I haven't read that case. I certainly have read Melendez-Diaz and wondered why I didn't raise it. Yes.
Before we get to that, although I'm prepared to get to that, there's another issue I have, and that is what is all of this hearsay issue?
Yeah.
Does that come in with your confrontation, or is that separate? I mean, I know that in confrontation we get to hearsay. But so, are they related?
Pardon?
Is your hearsay argument related to confrontation, or is it separate?
I think that those are separate arguments.
Okay. So tell me about where does your hearsay argument come in if you hear these two steps?
I mean, what's one of the difficulties in this case, and maybe why I've overlooked a couple possible theories, is that there are several theories that I think all get to the same result. I mean, Hansen and Doar don't really talk about a rule of evidence. The cases that I rely on, they cite the cases, they have principles, I searched them to look for a rule of evidence and couldn't find one. The trial judge said it came in as a hearsay exception for the records of regularly conducted activity, and it was challenged under that one.
That's that certificate of what it said, what the printout is that what we're
yes.
talking about?
Okay. He took it in as that, and then there's this whole discussion in the legal literature and the law review articles we cited, et cetera, about whether computer-generated records, which I think this falls in, should be analyzed under the hearsay exception for regularly conducted activity, or whether it should be analyzed under authenticity. So our briefs address both of those theories as well. And I think they're just alternative theories. All of these are alternative theories to come down to this real issue of reliability and accuracy. I mean, that's my thought, my bottom line. But I do think it makes sense for this court to try to decide if it's going to be called on authenticity or if it's going to be called hearsay. I think, but for me, it doesn't matter too much.
So let's make sure I understand your terminology. When you say authenticity, are you going back to your first two principles of scientific basis for the instrument and the validity of this particular instrument? Are you saying that's authenticity? And then are you saying that that's one way of analyzing it? Another way of analyzing it is through the hearsay?
Right. I think so. The authenticity is actually a statute. It's 909.015 parens 9 is what I cite in the brief. And it says, if you're looking for authenticity analysis, evidence describing a process or system used to produce a result and showing that the process or system produces an accurate result is sufficient basis to introduce something. So that seems very, very close to being exactly the Hansen, Doar, and my standard. That seems to be almost circular. But the court didn't call it that in Hansen or Doar.
The court, okay.
In Hansen or Doar. So that's why I did it separately in my brief. Mm-hmm. I think it comes around to the same thing. And then, if you look at the hearsay analysis.
Okay. Now, in this case, you had a human being testifying as to the bringing in a piece of paper, right? Computer printout, and testifies as to the monitor generally. What does the testimony as to this specific monitor for accuracy?
Testimony as to the specific monitor was, I was using it at him, there were never any mistakes, and now they're using it up in Ashland, and there's no mistakes up there either.
No particular testing for this particular?
Not an iota of testing.
Okay.
And a lot of hearsay, by the way.
All right. And then testifies as to the certificate. Okay.
Right. And, I mean, if you look at hearsay, I mean, the part of hearsay, the exception that I focused on was whether this was a person with knowledge or a qualified witness who actually was qualified to talk about this document.
And that's remarkably similar to the authentication analysis. It seems to me that's that foundational element of the business records exception really is the same kind of inquiry you have akin to the inquiry with regard to authentication.
Exactly. And if you look at Ralph Adam Fine, he actually says, okay, if we're going to apply hearsay to computer-generated documents, here's the factors that should be considered. And one of them is, does the software generating the document do what it purports to do? I mean, I think, again, these are all coming to that principle, and it's an underlying principle of all evidence. It's reliability and accuracy. And what are we going to require? And I think the bottom line for me, for our side, is here that if you're going to use a machine or a device, then objective testing is the way that you show accuracy and reliability, and you bring in somebody who can testify about how this device works and how it's been tested to be accurate, why it's accurate, why it purports to do what it's supposed to do.
Okay. Now, what about whether you use your foundation, which is the general particular machine, or you use hearsay and authenticating it? You've got someone who's testifying. Now, in Melendez-Diaz, you had somebody who testified, right? You just didn't bring in a piece of paper.
That actually was an affidavit in Melendez-Diaz, but it's applied pretty frequently to having somebody testify who wasn't the actual analyst.
Okay, and that's the problem. It wasn't the actual analyst. Testified about the lab, testified about the result, but you didn't have an actual analyst. And then in the New Mexico Bull Cumming case, it is a blood alcohol content, right? Mm-hmm. And they admitted the report, right? And the police officer testified as an expert on the cause of the rear end, but that there was an issue of whether there's a constitutional error on hearsay or non-constitutional. So where do we have a confrontation case here? Do we have a confrontation question here?
I think we do because, I mean, if we accept that we need evidence that shows that this is accurate and reliable, what we are missing is a person who actually runs these computers. I mean, I think that that's your confrontation issue. If you're going to have a computer printout, then a person who was actually there, ran the computer, presumably checked it for accuracy near to the time of this, is the person who has to come in and describe the procedures. And it's exactly what happened in this case with the chemist from the lab coming in on the BAC. The chemist who testified came in and testified how he did it, what they checked, how that test was run, and what results he got. And I think under confrontation analysis, that's exactly the same thing here. It's a direct analogy.
So that's the only one you could cross-examine.
Right, because what can I ask, you know, what could anybody ask her? She's never even been to the electronic monitoring center. You know, my question is, when that printout came in and it said 2203, did you check it against anything? Was your clock, did you look at your clock? Did you check some alternative source, outside source, to see if that was correct? Did you call and see if he was home? And the person who might have done any of those things was not in court. And I think it does raise a confrontation issue.
Justice Prosser had a question.
I'm not sure I understand. When you ask for some sort of an expert, are you talking about in one case so that we establish the reliability of the device, or are you asking for an expert in every case?
If you're looking at that first step of the underlying scientific principles, then I would say either a case decision from, a one-case decision from this court based on evidence. I don't think that one trial court can make that decision, but if it gets to this court, then that would be enough. If this court says, we have heard the evidence, or we observed the evidence, we've read the evidence, an expert came in, he explain this to our satisfaction. It's a scientifically accepted basis for this system. And so from here on, it's accepted in Wisconsin. We are going to accept the underlying scientific basis. And then, as we do with intoxilizers, then the next question is just then, in subsequent trials, the question will be just bringing in your deputy to explain that the machine was working properly, or your witness to explain that the machine was working properly. I don't think we've reached the first step with this particular kind of evidence yet.
Your confrontation argument would seem to require that you bring someone in from Madison in every case.
It's probably the same person, actually. I would guess are very similar people who work in this computer center in Madison. Just as we bring in crime lab experts whenever we do a crime lab test, use it for evidence at trial. But you have to, the other thing I just want, if you're thinking about, is this a terrible burden, I just want to mention, this is, I mean, we haven't been able to find a case where this was used as evidence at trial. I mean, in most drunk driving cases, you've got your officer on the scene. You have witnesses about the driving. And so it's not like we're going to be pulling people out of this monitoring center every day to run out to a trial court somewhere in Wisconsin. It's a pretty unusual case where you have absolutely no witnesses. You have to rely on this computer printout.
It seems to me the defendant's theory is that he was at home until about 9 o'clock in the evening and then drove to his estranged wife's house or whatever, however that relationship is, about shortly after 9 o'clock. And if the machine was supposed to work properly, it should have alerted as soon as he left the house at shortly after 9 o'clock, and it didn't do that.
Right.
Why did it do it at 10:03?
I don't know.
I mean, is there some suggestion that somehow the machine was malfunctioning between 9 and 10:03 and then suddenly went back to work?
The suggestion is simply that we don't know, that the state didn't meet its burden of proving that 10:03 time was an accurate and reliable time. Again, I think it has to do with the burden of proof. Mr. Kanducha's testimony was that he did leave a little after 9 and he went to a bar and drank after
that. What bar was that?
Pardon?
What bar was that?
You know, I can't remember the name of it. It actually had a funny name. It was
Cops.
Cops. I remember it being court-related. Cop shop. The cop shop. And, you know, the thing I remember is he drank $20 worth of Southern Comfort, which is, but...
Was there any corroborating evidence that he went to Cops and spent $20 on Southern Comfort?
No, it was just his testimony.
Oh, but there was highly competent defense counsel in this case.
Yes.
Come there was no evidence that he had been at Cops Bar drinking $20 worth of Southern Comfort.
I look at the record in the case. I don't check into the investigation that took place in this case. I don't know the answer. I do know that the trial took place several years after the incident because there had been earlier a mistrial and then an interlocutory appeal, and then we were back several years later. But I think this is about the burden of proof. I don't know which, you know, this is the state has to prove its case. And the question is, when in proving that case, was this document, should this document have been admitted or not? Whether Mr. Kanducha had other evidence or his attorney didn't investigate or whatever, I have no way of knowing.
How far away was Cops?
He said it was a few blocks, as I recall. And I haven't been to Wausau, to the bars in Wausau, so I don't know for sure.
Well, if you want to call an expert on the issue, need not look too far, Justice Brasser.
I am out of time. I know Justice Rogenczyk was going to ask a question earlier. Do you?
Well, my question was going to be the concern for accuracy is simply with the time, right?
Yes, although we don't know. I mean, I don't want to say we don't know what might have caused an inaccurate time. I mean, maybe there was a concern with the bracelet that caused the inaccurate time. We just don't know what the cause
is. It's the time.
It's the time is the issue.
That's all I just wanted to be sure of.
So is his story that he drove to his estranged wife's house, parked the van in a lot, then walked several blocks to Cops, and then walked back after spending $20 on Southern Comfort? Is that the story?
And actually, it has one other wrinkle, which I didn't go into, which is that what he testified to is that he knocked on his wife's door, and there was no answer, there was nobody home. And so that's when he walked down to the street to the bar. That was his testimony. Exactly. Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Stephen P. Means, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Means.
Thank you. May it please the court. A couple of preliminary matters. First of all, I think it's important to recognize what $20 buys in the way of alcohol in Wausau. The testimony was that he drank approximately 6 to 7 shots of Southern Comfort, which is 100 proof whiskey, plus a pitcher of beer. So that's not $20 on booze in Madison. The second point.
Cap shop is a little
different. And you're correct. And you're correct. Under Mr. Kanduch's story, he would have parked the car, he would have walked what was said to be 3 blocks, it may have been as much as a half mile, he would have made that walk, he would have sat down, he would have ordered, consumed, and paid for shot 1, shot 2, shot 3, shot 4, shot 5, shot 6, shot 7. That may have taken 20 minutes there, plus a pitcher of beer, and then he walked back. That gets to what I agree is the key point in this case. Can you trust the results of the electronic monitoring records in this case? And I suggest to you that you can. And in fact, we may have evidence here that may represent the gold standard of reliability. I see that the judges have had before them a copy of the electronic monitoring report that was in the appendix. I'd ask you to turn to that. The one I'm looking at is at page 167.
Of the blue brief?
The appellant's appendix.
That's the blue brief. Give me the page number again. I'm sorry. The page number again.
167 of the appendix.
Okay. That's the one we've been looking at.
Okay. And what you'll see is 4 entries, and the 4th one being transmitter out of range. So you have 3 prior entries of the electronic monitoring system sending a signal to the computer and the computer making a note of that. The first one was at 3:05 that afternoon. At trial, Mr. Kanduch said, yes, that's correct. I did come into range at that time. The second one is at 3:25. And at trial, Mr. Kanduch said, yes, that's correct. I did go out of range at that time. And the third one is at 6:27. And at trial, Mr. Kanduch testified, yes, I did come back into range at that time. So what we have is something that may be better than testing. We have the admission by a defendant under oath that the system was working that day, just hours before the critical time, and it only failed to work at the critical time. Now, add that to the fact that we know that it shows him going out of range at 10:03. We know, because it was the testimony, that it takes 15 to 20 minutes to get from where Mr. Kanduch was to where he went. 10:03 to 10:23, which is when his wife called the police, is 20 minutes. Now, if it malfunctioned, Mr. Kanduch may have been the most unfortunate person in history, because the timing is exactly what it would be if the electronic monitoring system was working correctly. Now, Justice Abramson, you asked if there was testimony as to the specific monitor, and Ms. Hirsch said, well, there wasn't really much, other than Agent Karkowski saying that she didn't have any problems. Well, that's not true. This was set up approximately 2 weeks or 2 months before the date in question. At that time, Agent Karkowski testified that you send out a transport sergeant who gets everything set up, and then they do a test, which means they initiate a call from the center to see if they're getting what's called a hello. It means it establishes the telephone connection. So that happened.
Well, I see hello is on the next page.
The next page is a documentation of that initial test, I believe. Well, no, that's not correct. A hello is what they call it anytime the monitoring center calls to see if it's working. And that's done randomly every 4 to 5 hours. So this is constantly being tested in terms of the connection.
Counsel, a problem I have with your argument is that it uses
the individual facts of this case as a support for reliability. And, of course, what happens in this individual case is important, and it's important to the defendant, but we're a little broader than that in terms of the reason that we took the case, not just for error correcting in this case. And I think seldom in future cases will you have a defendant admitting this prior to the court having to deal with the admissibility issue. State goes first. State wants to put it on. The state's not going to have any admission as to the accuracy of the times. And so although, and I don't know, but let's say for argument's sake, this is sufficiently a support to the indicia of reliability, to the accuracy of the device, that doesn't really get us anywhere beyond the individual facts of this case. And I want to get beyond that.
Well, and I understand that. I'm here because a person who committed a felony was convicted, and we're trying to uphold that conviction.
You may be here for that, but we're not here for that. I don't care if the conviction is upheld or not. I'm here for a rule of law. So that's what I need help with.
Sure. And I think we have the rule of law. And the rule of law is in the rules of evidence, which talks about what's needed to authenticate a processor system. And that says that you need evidence describing the processor system. We have that. We had Agent Klarkowski testify as to how the bracelet talks to the monitoring unit. The monitoring unit talks to the computer. A result is generated.
Tell me how the bracelet talks to the monitoring system. Can you explain that to me, how that works?
It's battery-powered. It wraps around the ankle, and it transmits a radio signal,
mm-hmm.
a common radio signal going back to Marconi, Tesla, all of those folks. That signal.
Listen, I'm a person who still marvels at how electricity works, so you're going to have to help me. I mean, I think that's a miracle.
Yes. It's a constant signal, but it's a weak signal, which
mm-hmm.
means that when you go 150 feet or 150 yards away, the signal stops, and that's when the home monitoring unit sends a signal to the computer.
Now, where's the computer?
The computer's located at the Electronic Monitoring Center in Madison.
Okay. Now, how does that work?
How does what work?
Well, this is in Wausau. That's in Madison. What's the...
From a technological standpoint?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah. What's the underlying scientific reliability? How does this work?
You know, I don't know exactly, but I assume that it's very similar to what we look at on our phone bills when it says that a phone call was made on a certain time and that's registered by a computer. Or, you know, various other things that we see that are generated by machines that involve storing information, making a note of when an event occurs, mm-hmm. and then making a record of that.
If I were sitting as a trial judge and I had an attorney cross-examining an expert in this area, they would say, you know, explain to us how it works. And I think that the answer that it works like our telephone bill might get you to first base, but it doesn't get you to home plate, because you got to explain how that works to me then. You know, I mean, what are the underlying, this is a device, and there's science involved.
Right.
So what are the underlying scientific principles that support the reliability of this?
Well, and that I think is an interesting question, because the question was asked, well, who would you have come talk about this? And she said, well, someone at the monitoring center who's familiar with the computer. Well, I don't know what that person would say. They might say, we bought a commercial program that said it would do this. We installed the program, and it works. And I suggest that we have the equivalent of that evidence here, because we have agents, Agent Klarkowski, who worked 5 years with electronic monitoring, her supervisor, who had worked more than 20 years. They get these reports all the time, and there's never been an error. They've never heard of an error. And to me, that is more solid than having a technician or an engineer coming in and saying, we have a circuit here, and it's wired with this frequency, and it makes, turns the ones and zeros, digits into a piece of communication.
Could be,
And help me with this, but my recollection of the testimony is that you have the agent, and she had used this device, was it 30 times?
No. She had supervised approximately 30 to 34 people wearing an electronic bracelet.
That's right. And over what period of time did she have experience with this 30 to 34?
About 5 years.
Okay. So 5 years, 30 to 34 people over the course of that 5 years. And I think her testimony is she never had a problem with any of that. Is that right?
Her testimony was that she never had a problem mm-hmm. and that she'd never heard of anyone who had had a problem with a false out-of-range report.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay. And so she was in Wausau, and that's her 30 to 34 cases in 5 years. You think that's enough to establish the underlying scientific reliability, the accuracy of the system?
Well, I think in, you know, that would be a different issue than what we have here, because here we not only have her testimony, we have that of her supervisor, who had been involved with it for 20 years.
Yeah, I read that testimony.
His testimony was the same.
Testimony was pretty brief.
Well, it was brief but unequivocal.
And that was Williams, as I recall.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And he was asked, are you aware in connection with your employment certifications? And here it is. Have you... during your 30 years in the department, have you ever heard of a monitoring unit in connection with your employment indicating something occurred when it did not? And he said, no, they're meant to go the other way. And that was it's pretty brief, direct examination. I mean, I understand, for instance, he testified that he's been familiar with the unit for 20 years. He's been using it in Wausau since 1994. I just wasn't able to ascertain from these 1, 2, 3 pages of direct examination really the nature and extent of his training and experience with this. Are you able to... help me with that in those pages of direct?
No, I believe the testimony is that he was Agent Klarkowski's supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
I assume he supervises more than one agent, but the record doesn't say.
Mm-hmm.
That he's been in the field of corrections for 34 years.
That's right.
And that he's used electronic monitoring for 20 years.
That's right.
And he's never had any problems, and he's not been made aware of other problems. He also testified, or I think it was Agent Klarkowski, testified that on any given day, there's around 2,000 people on the program. They consider it a routine and important supervision tool. And so it's clearly something that the Department of Corrections, carrying out a very important job, believes is reliable.
He testified that all the hope I'm not overstating it, that the parole and probation officers got testing on these training with respect to these monitors as part of their general training.
Yes. Yes. He testified that there is general training when agents started and that, as with other matters, when there's updates or new things to learn, that people are given updates.
But no verification of any of these monitors.
In terms of?
That was working properly.
Well, right. And I think that that's important to think about what this monitor does. When you talk about an intoxilizer, that doesn't just measure whether somebody breathed in. That measures what's in the breath. And so it's a more complex process when you're trying to measure the chemical content of a vapor than it is when you're trying to find out, you know, did a radio signal get interrupted?
Is this like a GPS?
Well, it's less complex than a GPS, but even the GPS technology in a decision that I think both parties have cited, the Thistle case out of Massachusetts, the courts have said that's been around long enough to accept.
Counsel, a few moments ago you started sort of building the case for corroboration for accuracy in this instance. Should we be concerned in future cases where there's not quite such a verification by a source, in this instance it happened to come from the defendant, should we be concerned that in future cases we might be requiring, where, for instance, there is no long-time supervisor, the agent was just recently trained and just got on the job. There is not such a cooperative and accommodating defendant. Should we be concerned that we're asking judges and juries in other instances to take a lot on faith here?
Well, I think there's really two issues here. One is, you know, is a new rule needed? And I don't think it is, because I think 909.015 covers the base. It says you can have evidence of a process or system if it produces an accurate result. Now, going forward, I understand that prosecutors and defense counsel are going to want to know what does that mean, and I think it's certainly appropriate for this court, if it chooses, to maybe give some explanation of that, or maybe to say, going forward, we are going to accept that technology. And I think it would be appropriate to do that. The claim has been made, well, you know, this hasn't been around long enough, you know, there haven't been enough case decisions, but let's look at what there have been. She identified three cases. That left out a fourth, which is the Court of Appeals case in this one. That's four cases which have said, you know, this technology is pretty standard. It's been around long enough. We understand it. It's reliable. On the other hand, there's no cases that say something to the contrary. So it's not like you have a dispute and things need to work their way through the courts. You've had four appellate courts consider the issue, and they've all come down in the same way.
Tell me what technology we're talking about, because there are lots of different kinds of bracelets. Indeed, the newest bracelets, at least that I'm aware, are called the smart bracelets. They not only can tell where a person is, they may have a GPS, not just a signal about where you're at a range, but exactly where you are. They test sweat so they can tell whether or not there's a drug that's being used or alcohol being used. I don't know what else they have in that little chip, but a lot. So that is a very different bracelet, if I understand it, than this bracelet. So if we do what you say, don't we have to say, well, electronic bracelet model 3205-66, I made that up, is sound or is okay. And then what do we do it on? Do we do it just on the testimony here? Now, we have an appendix, but I see that there are two separate boxes of testimony here. So if we accept your argument, what do we exactly say? All electronic bracelets? Only radio-computer and Madison bracelets? You know what I'm trying to say to you?
Yeah, I think I understand that, and let me give one semi-contentious answer, and then I'll get into the longer answer. And the semi-contentious one is that we are not the appellant, and so you don't have to accept our argument to affirm the circuit court. She's got to show that an error was committed. Now,
your argument, if I understand it, is forget the bracelet. We've got enough testimony and enough evidence aside from the bracelets to support the conviction. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. But I also understand that the court may want to go a step beyond affirming this conviction and give some guidance for the future, which I think is appropriate.
Okay.
And in response to your question, I think you have to look at the technologies.
Mm-hmm.
We have here is a simple communication of radio frequency to a receiver and transmission of that information over the telephone line. I think if you uphold that technology using those processes, you're not saying that if a bracelet also locates somebody via GPS, that you have to accept that, or if it tests sweat to determine drug content, you have to accept that. Those are different technologies.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to get at.
And certainly, you know, I don't think GPS and a chemical test could be treated the same. Because, again, GPS is more about locating. It's more about sending signals. And a sweat analysis involves a chemical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, if you're asking me what rule of law would be appropriate, I think the rule would be to reaffirm 909.0115 and to say that where the process involves an electronic monitoring function, which involves the transmission of a radio signal from a bracelet to a receiver, which then records an interruption in that signal on a computer, that no further expert testimony is needed. Now, that would not excuse a need for testimony as to the reliability of a particular unit, because I do think that's important, and I do think that that is more than adequately covered in the present case.
When you say a particular unit, what do you mean? And then as after you answer that, I'd ask you to talk about what, if any, kind of periodic testing of this device is done to ensure that it's in working order.
By particular unit, I meant the one that Mr. Kanduch was wearing.
Okay. What kind of periodic testing is done of these devices?
After the initial setup is done, it's confirmed to the agent via fax. So the setup is what triggers the fax to the agent.
A setup for each individual person?
Yes.
Okay.
This agent also has a practice of, upon receiving the fax, calling and saying, I got the fax, is everything good to go, and is told yes.
Despite the individual facts of this case, and
yes,
they are important.
Yes.
But overall, is there a systematic manner, a systematic way in which the reliability of these are tested?
Yes.
Okay.
What happens is this is hooked up, the monitoring unit, to the computer. And when there's a break in the signal, the unit calls the computer. But because the computer wants to know if the phone line is still good, if the bridge is still open, the computer will call the monitoring unit every 4 to 5 hours. And it's kind of random, but it averages about 4 to 5 hours, which means 5 to 6 times a day, it's verifying that the communication system is working.
Who is alerted if it's not?
The probation agent who's been assigned gets the alert. Now, if there's a disconnect between the bracelet and the monitoring unit, what happens is it shows up as the person being out of range. For example, if the bracelet stops sending a signal, it shows they're out of range, a signal would be sent, the agent would follow up and presumably call and learn that the battery was dead or whatever. So there are ways that mistakes are uncovered. There is testing. And again, there's as much testing as there needs to be. If people have a clock, you know, they may set the clock. They don't have to check it by Greenwich Mean Time 6 times a day. You know, they may check it periodically, or they may assume that it's going to be working unless they see something odd with it. And where you have a system that's been in place for 20 years, people have never seen any errors, you have to take that into account when deciding what level of testing is appropriate. And here I think the fact that the system has no history of problems, I think the testing they do is more than adequate.
Counsel, I hear in your response what happens, but I want to know how it works. That is, I understand, or at least I've been told, that the electronic monitoring system involves 3 separate technological processes.
Yes.
Can you describe what those 3 are and how they work?
Sure. The first process is the generation of a radio signal with the bracelet.
So that's the generation of the radio signal from the bracelet to what?
To what's called a home monitoring unit, which,
okay,
think of a box. Mm-hmm. And that box plugs into an outlet, and it also plugs into a phone line.
So a radio signal goes
to the box.
Okay, so there it goes. I mean, okay.
There it goes.
Okay. Then you've got the box, and then there's a second technological process. And what is that?
Yes. the box detects whether it's receiving a signal. And as long as it's receiving a signal, everything is good. If it doesn't receive a signal, then it communicates with the computer in the monitoring center.
Okay. The next one that I have written here is the transmission of the information from the HMU to the monitoring center via phone line.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So how does that work, that this box how does that work?
I don't know. It's I assume it's an automated call that's, you know, figured with, I better not get into electronics. That's why I became a lawyer, because I was not very technically inclined. But there was not that type of technical evidence in the record to show exactly how it works.
Okay. Then the next, then, so it goes to the phone line, and it goes to the monitoring center via phone line, however that works. And then at the monitoring center, does the phone line feed into a computer? Is it hooked up? Is there a phone line that's hooked up to a computer?
Yes, there's a computer on the other end of the phone line.
Okay. And do we know anything about how that computer translates this call into information that is important for us?
Right. Not at the technological level, I think you may be asking, but it does. There was testimony that, for example, a person will have a schedule, and if they're allowed to be out of range at the time they're shown to be out of range, then the computer notes that, it tells itself this isn't a problem, and so it doesn't send an alert. Whereas if a person goes out of range when they're not supposed to be, it does send an alert to the probation agent. And
I hear that as that's the results rather than the workings, right. And I think we're both on the same wavelength with regard to that.
But
if this were just a phone record, how would it be introduced?
If this were just a phone record, I believe it would be, for example, a business phone record. I think you would have someone from the business who comes in and says, this is the phone record that we've received from the telephone company.
Okay. And if you were getting a phone record from the telephone company, would you have someone explain how telephones work and how their computer system works and how their computer system takes a phone number and generates a particular document in a particular way?
You know, I think what you would have, and this may be similar to the United States versus Fujai case that we cite, I think you'd have someone testify that when such and such happens, it makes a note on our system. I've pulled these documents off the system. I've compared them to what's on the system, and this is a true and correct copy of a business record created at the time of the events.
They wouldn't describe the computer program that creates that document, would they? I've just never heard of that, when trying cases or as a judge.
That's correct. And I think, I don't know if this court recalls the Mercer case. Actually, maybe that was a court of appeals case. But there's a statement in there quoting another court, and I apologize I don't have it with me, but the gist of it is, look, we know computers do stuff. This isn't new. And, you know, the fact that computers are able to generate entries as to when certain event happens, that's not new. You get it with call logs. You get it with sniffer logs that show when people log on to websites. You get it when a fax is sent from a computer that generates a timestamp. So there's many ways that computers note events
court
at certain
reporters,
times.
Court reporters, for example. Court reporters take down court hearings, and then they take that and somehow plug it into a computer, and it brings up what they end up certifying to be what happened in court based upon the computer generating that. But I've never really heard of someone having to explain how the computer program finds a way to plug into the court reporter system.
You know, one of the cases cited, I believe it was by the defendant, is a 1958 case from Ohio, and they were talking about Doppler speed radar. And the court in that case said, why should the time of experts be wasted and the expenses of litigation be increased by compelling such men to appear in court after court telling the same truths over and over? Rather, the applicable maxim should be, what the world generally knows a court of justice may be assumed to know. I think the world can be assumed to know that routine electronic monitoring that's used not only throughout Wisconsin to supervise dangerous criminals, but throughout the nation, works and is reliable. And I don't think you need expert testimony on the intricacies of sending computer signals and transmission of data in digital form for a jury to understand that this is reliable. My time's up. If there's no other questions, I will.
What about confrontation? Do you think that's involved in this case?
Your Honor, I'm now being exposed to someone who's not an experienced criminal appellate lawyer. I became aware of the Confrontation Clause issue yesterday when one of my colleagues said, aren't there Confrontation Clause issues here? I said, well, they didn't raise it. If that's something the court is interested in, we would be glad to brief it. I think in this case, to say briefly, there was an opportunity to confront the evidence that was provided. You can't confront a computer through testimony. There certainly is a way to, for defendants to do some type of discovery or to put on their own evidence, and so they could have confronted that evidence. And they did attack the evidence that was provided. There was a lot of cross-examination about, did you read the manual? Why isn't there a certification? So I think there was confrontation here. But in terms of the much of an in-depth analysis, I would ask that if the court is going to consider that, that we be allowed to submit something.
The issue is you got to get the right person. I mean, this person there. But the question is that the person that potentially has the answers to the significant questions? And that's the issue. And I also want to talk about hearsay because I get confused between this expert testimony issues and how it relates to hearsay.
I think that they are separate issues.
Okay.
And in this case, whether it's hearsay or not, the state still had to go through the authentication to show that it was the evidence was what it purports to be. So I do think they're separate analyses. Obviously, both of them are interested in getting good, reliable evidence to the court, but I think they're separate analyses.
Give it to me again. Why you think they're separate?
Well, because I think if it's hearsay, you've got to satisfy both rules. If it's hearsay, we could give evidence, we could give testimony that something is reliable.
Okay.
But if it's hearsay, we would either have to show that there's an exception that applies or it's being offered for something other than the truth.
And you're saying it's not hearsay?
It's not hearsay. That's correct.
Because it's not a statement that's intended by a person as an assertion.
Well, it's not hearsay because there's no person. There's no human being.
Well, person doesn't ordinarily, is not limited to human being.
Well, in this context, the rule suggests otherwise, because hearsay is a statement made out of court, offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And statement is defined in the rule, and it's defined with reference to a person.
It says a declarant is a person who makes a statement.
Right. And statement is defined, and that's also defined in reference to a person. We have cited numerous cases, and clearly all of the current cases and recent cases hold that something that is completely machine-generated cannot be considered hearsay. And the reason for that is the risk of hearsay aren't implicated. A machine's not going to lie. A machine's not going to forget. A machine isn't going to be a bad storyteller. And a machine isn't going to do the other things that you need to clean up and challenge through cross-examination. It's similar to a drug-sniffing dog. If they alert to something, you can't cross-examine them.
But you do put the trainer or the person who's dealing with the dog who explains the significance of whether the dog is quiet, whether the dog is yapping.
Yes, and I shouldn't have stepped into another issue that I know little about.
Fatal error. Okay, and your brief indicates that if we don't accept that this is not hearsay, then it's under the business records exception.
Yes. And let me make one other note, if I may, on the hearsay issue. The defendant's brief said that the issue that we're urging is a minority rule, and that's not true. That statement came from a 2005 student written law review article. The eight cases that the defendant cites in support of their claim that courts treat this stuff as hearsay, six of them don't even discuss the issue of whether a machine-generated statement satisfies the hearsay rule. One of the other two is an Illinois appellate court level case that's been superseded by an Illinois Supreme Court level case that comes to a contrary conclusion that's consistent with what we're urging. And the final case, I know that doesn't apply to, and I'm trying to find out why. The final case is Penny versus Commonwealth, and in that case, the court recognized that machine-generated reports of a call trap device did not involve a declarant under hearsay rules. It left the evidence out for other reasons, but it did not reach the issue that we're pursuing here. So you have an old law review article and eight cases that don't stand for the proposition for which they're offered.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Ms. Hirsch?
Let me begin by saying that 2005 seems like yesterday, and Ralph Adam Fine still considered it hearsay evidence in 2008 in his treatise. But I think what I want to focus on here is the probation officer's testimony and whether that is proof of reliability and accuracy. And the analogy I would make, Justice Ziegler, is to your court reporter case. If there was a question about a transcript and you had to decide that as a trial court judge, you would expect to see your court reporter or the court reporter who created that transcript in court. Now, maybe she wouldn't describe the whole process of how the computer works, but she would describe approximately how she takes it and how it goes through a computerized process and probably how she checks it to make sure it's accurate. What you have here is somebody like me coming in and saying, geez, I've been reading transcripts for 5 years now, and they all seem accurate to me. I mean, and it's as the other analogy I can think of is your sheriff's deputy. You have your sheriff's deputy come in and say, here's the machine, here's the test, I did this, I checked that. And instead, what they bring in is the DA who says, boy, every time I see these tests, they look accurate to me.
Ms. Hirsch, when I asked Mr. Means about the testing procedure that's followed, and I think what he indicated was that a signal, if there's a break in the signal, the probation officer is alerted, and then it's up to the probation officer to respond. And is that your understanding of where the testing ends on a routine basis?
That's all that the probation officer testified to in this case. She testified about the setup of the machine two months earlier, and she did testify that if there was a break in power or, I think, a break in the bracelet, that an alert, it would go to that electronic monitoring system, and they'd send an alert to her. So, again, I think if you bring in telephone records, you bring in somebody from the telephone company who explains how they check their records, what they do and how they check them. What they brought in here was the recipient of these records.
Does the record indicate that there's any additional testing besides the notification to the probation officer?
No. Not the kind of thing you would expect, for example, in an intoxilizer, which we see all the time, or what you see in your crime lab reports. And that's my... The other part of my rebuttal in this case is that, you know, there are varying levels of reliability. I think, you know, many of us make decisions on less than perfectly reliable and accurate information. But if you're making an important decision, you check and double-check your information. And we have determined that in courts, this is important. The information comes in as important, and it needs to be proved to be accurate and reliable. So the analogy I can think of, the police, I live near West High School, police check speeders going through to see if they should do some sort of an enforcement action in that area. Now, they're not ticketing people. They're just checking speed to get an idea of what it looks like. That's one level of reliability. They don't have to check their radar machine before and after to see how it's working. But if you're going to ticket somebody and bring them to court, then we expect to have testing of these kinds of devices to see if they work. probation agents use polygraphs. Now, if Agent Klarkowski came to this court and said, I use polygraphs all the time, I've been using them for many years, and I think that they are entirely reliable, I've never seen an error, is that going to convince you that you should change the rule on polygraphs and allowing those to be used in court proceedings? And I think the answer is no, because we don't have accurate, reliable, objective testing showing that polygraphs are reliable. I think agents can use these things for purposes of supervision. And what is the purpose of getting these reports? To go out and check. The report itself is not conclusive and doesn't reach the level of accuracy and reliability that we would, but that we do require in our court systems because of the importance of the decisions that are made in court.
I have two questions. One, and I intended to ask this of Mr. Means, but I'll ask it of you. It was not quite clear to me that whether Mr. Means' response to Justice Bradley in explaining the system was his statement or whether it was derived from the record.
Okay. I did learn something new when he spoke, and I can't remember what it was. There was one thing he said that I hadn't heard before, and now I can't see from my notes what it was. I think she did explain, you know, about how this. Well, I know it was that the radio frequency is weak enough so that it stops if you're more than 150 feet away. That wasn't explained at trial. But you know, she did explain this idea of, you know, radio frequency sending something to the telephone. There's no testimony about what triggers the telephone to make a telephone call, how that radio talks to the telephone. It just does somehow.
In fairness, I think the question that had been put to him is what is his understanding
of how it works.
I agree.
But if you ask what the difference is, I think she testified that happened, but she couldn't explain why, and I'm not sure Mr. Means could either. And then she explained that this telephone call went to the Electronic Monitoring Center, and she really knew nothing about that except that she got a report back.
And when did the probation officer check?
She doesn't say. She does say she wasn't working that night. So a warrant apparently went out at 22:23:03 at 11:03, and she didn't get it because she wasn't working that night. So I don't know when she got it. Probably, I'm guessing, the next day, but it's not clear in the record.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Thank you, Mr. Means, for the excellent argument about technological devices. We had a case on the GPS, and now we have a different form of electronic information. And so concludes our hearing on 09-AP-1351-CR. State versus Candidge. The students will remain, and Justice Gableman will be out to speak with you in a few minutes. We are in recess until 1:30.